It's Wednesday, March 10th, 2021, and this is another socially distant edition of KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Amy Simons, coming to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. My colleagues, Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley, are with me, as always, for our weekly conversation on media behaviors. Hi, Ernest.
Hi, Amy.
And Kathy, good to have you with us today.
Hey, Amy and Ernest, it's good to see you.
On our program this week,
if a member of his family will comfortably say, we've all had to deal with things that are rude. Rude and racist are not the same.
No, they're not. There are many different angles we're going to cover connected to Oprah Winfrey's interview with Meghan and Harry. They're saying that the world is watching what's happening in a Hennepin County courthouse where Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is now on trial in the death of George Floyd. While in Des Moines, a journalist is on trial for failing to follow police orders, her arrest coming while covering Black Lives Matter protests of Floyd's death. And it looks like we've got quite a story to cover in the coming months here in Missouri as Senator Roy Blunt says he's not going to seek re-election. There are a few other things that I want to ask Ernest and Kathy about, depending on how much time we have left before our half hour is up. So we're going to get started and talk about Oprah's sit down with Meghan and Harry. 2 hours on CBS Sunday night, unaired clips on CBS this morning, Monday, 17.1 million viewers. Maybe it's the circles I'm running in, but it seems like it's all that people have been talking about all this week. First question, real quick, from each of you. Kathy, you first. Did you watch the whole thing?
I did not.
You did not. Okay. And Ernest?
No, I did not.
I did catch the part that I think we're going to talk about here in a minute, but I did not catch the whole thing.
Okay. So with that established, I want to be able to start our conversation talking about Oprah and her approach to this interview. Ironically, it was exactly 2 years ago this week that we were talking on this very program, Ernest, you, me, and Mike McKean, about Gail King's sit down with R. Kelly and how it was truly a masterclass in interviewing. Kathy, I can't help but think, as good as it was, King's bestie bested her on this one. Let's take a listen to it.
So we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security. He's not going to be given a title. And also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
What?
And
who is having that conversation with you? What?
So,
there is a conversation. Hold up.
There's
Stop
several
right now.
There are several conversations.
There's a
about
conversation
it.
With you.
With Harry.
About how dark your baby is going to be?
Potentially, and what that would mean or look like. That was relayed to me from Harry.
Oprah asked Prince Harry about that discussion when he joined the interview.
What was that conversation?
That conversation I'm never going to share. But at the time it was awkward. I was a bit shocked.
Can you tell us what the question was?
No, I'm not comfortable sharing that.
So Kathy, I want you to talk for a minute about how Oprah used follow-up questions to really get most of the newsiest parts of this discussion.
Yeah, there's a great piece about her technique on the BBC website, which is interesting because it's one of the few British outlets that really fully acknowledges the significance of this interview. But I think what makes Oprah a good interviewer is that she is human. She really doesn't over prep she reacts the way a human being would react. And that clip you showed was a perfect example. The drop of the jaw, the pause. And I think it was a genuine reaction, and it probably summed up what a lot of people were thinking. And that's what makes her a very good interviewer. She is a very empathetic human being. And I think it's interesting that her interview is being celebrated this week, and the same week another well-known television star who was briefly worked over on this side of the pond, Piers Morgan, lost his job
So we're going to talk about him and what's going on in the UK in a few minutes. I want to focus first on some of the techniques that Oprah was using here. Ernest, some of the best questions that she asked weren't even questions at all. They were facial expressions. They were extended pauses. They were huh or kind of guttural noises that really just opened the door for Meghan and Harry to keep talking and to really elicit response. It's a hard thing to do.
Well, I think one of the things that Oprah's really good at, and she's been doing this for a long time, but one of the things that you see about her techniques and the way she goes about it is that she really elicits conversation. It's not so much a, I'm going to ask you a question, you respond, I ask another question. It's more of a, we're having a conversation as if, you know, we're friends, we're either at the dinner table, or we're having breakfast together, or we're sitting at the bar. That's what makes her such a very good interviewer. And there are very few people who have the ability to do this in our field. I mean, even when you go back from a historical perspective, there's very few. I mean, Ted Koppel was one who could get people to do these kinds of interviews where they are opening up, but they're opening up because they entered into a conversation with Oprah about various topics, and then all of it starts to come out. And then when they bring it together, you get this real appearance as if, hey, we're sitting down having a conversation and you've just thrown something out at me that I was not expecting.
So do you think, Kathy, in some of those situations where she was doing that, that Meghan and Harry were maybe caught off guard in some ways? Because you saw that there were some moments, too, where, like, Meghan really paused. And we even saw some of that in the clip and took the time to be very mindful about what was going to come out of her mouth and what she was going to say next, as opposed to simply reacting and answering the question.
Well, I think this gets to what Oprah did very well, which is use silence. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we talk to students about, is letting the interviewee fill the silence. And by not jumping in when your interviewee pauses and filling that silence, letting it hang there, eventually that person is going to start talking. And I think that she used that very effectively in her interview. And one of the points that the BBC piece made that I thought was interesting was that Oprah is a celebrity, at least equivalent to Harry and Meghan. So she had that a certain self-confidence and if you will, a rapport. They're part of that same over-scrutinized club of people. And I think that also made her a more effective interviewer in this situation.
One of the things that I also noticed and appreciated as a journalist and watching how she approached that interview was how she didn't give them any free passes. One of the things that stood out to me, too, was when she asked very specifically and looked at Harry and said, come on, how can you say that you were trapped and that you didn't have privilege? You were literally a prince. But there was part of me, too, that wanted just a little bit more and wanted statements that could be verified. Is there fault in her not pushing Ernest a little bit further to find out who made the statements about Archie's skin tone, if it was a relative or if it was employee? Were there things that, or who denied Meghan the mental health care? Were there things you were left wanting to know? Like, give me more detail? Did she give them a little bit of a pass and backing off there?
Well, I think in any kind of an interview, you're going to leave the viewer, the listener, the reader wanting more. It's her technique is not to the conversational technique that she uses is not to sort of be too evasive to the point where the person shuts down and then you shut down the conversation. And she comes right up to that point, and then she realizes, okay, If I go one more step further, I'm probably going to shut this thing down, and I have other areas that I want to cover. And so I don't want to stifle the entire conversation and lose the possibility of being able to get to these other points. And I think that's sort of, you know, where Oprah goes with this. But it does, as you say, leave the audience wanting more answers to various questions.
So, Kathy, you had started to talk a little bit earlier, and I wanted to make sure we did spend some time on this about what happened yesterday with Piers Morgan, in which he got into a heated debate. You can see the full video of it on our Links blog, but with one of his co-anchors, and ended up walking off of the set and resigning his position on Good Morning Britain, an ITV program. The differences in the coverage as a whole as well in the newspapers in Britain, in the UK, versus what we are seeing here in the United States. Very different, going right back almost to that line from Meghan, that there's a difference between rude and racist. Did the British cross the line in what had gone on there?
Well, I think you've seen that we've looked at some stories over the past where the contrasting headlines about Kate Middleton, the other princess, and Meghan, and it's really clear she's been treated in a different way. And when the head of the Society of Newspaper Editors in England had to go out and say, "We're not racist." Well, that sounds like Nixon saying, "I'm not a crook." And so I didn't think it was a really good look. And I think, this made me Q. Lee Greenwood proud to be an American. I thought, boy, that revolution was a really good idea, and getting rid of the monarchy was a really good idea. I don't know why people obsess over these things. So I'm not an obsessive, but since we are talking about this story, it is clear that one princess was treated very differently from another, and it is clear what the reason for that is. And I think the British press, and Piers Morgan he's a casualty of that, and he should be.
Ernest, you've spent time both with the university and in other capacities living in London and doing some extensive work there. And in some ways, it kind of makes you, within our group right now, kind of the royal family coverage expert. There was something else that came out in this interview that kind of made me feel kind of icky. And I guess I kind of knew it existed, but that symbiotic relationship that the royal family has with the tabloids, that they host them at parties in the palace in exchange for working with them on favorable media coverage. Having that come out in this discussion, having some of the other descriptions of stories, the idea of did Kate make Meghan cry or did Meghan make Kate cry, and how was that handled by Buckingham Palace versus the tabloids, etc. It just, I don't know, I had a question and now it's kind of escaped me, but there is this icky symbiotic relationship between the two that in our system just it doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel journalistic.
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, there is that relationship there, and it's been there for a long time. And some would equate that, the relationship that the tabloids and other British press have with the royals, to somewhat the relationship that that White House correspondents or the White House press corps has with the president. I mean, there was a chummy relationship between various reporters over time, starting back with FDR, and he would have these chats that weren't public. And then you have various other presidents, and that sort of fell by the wayside during Watergate. It came back to a certain extent during the Reagan era and the Bush the first era, and then it's gone down. So you have that kind of relationship. But I would say this British style is more along the lines of they're treated as Hollywood stars in some ways. And they have that sort of Hollywood kind of relationship with the tabloids. And there's this sort of quid pro quo where we will give you access and we will do these things if you make sure that the coverage sort of fits with the way the royals are supposed to be treated, or the royals are supposed to be seen by their various subjects around the Commonwealth. And so this is, and that sort of played out on a grand scale in this sort of Meghan and Harry era, where they basically said, look, we're not going to adhere to some of these agreements that have been made between the firm, which is what the handlers of the royals, and the British tabloids. We're not going to play in that space. we're going to craft our own narrative and we're going to control our own narrative. And if that means we have to separate ourselves from the royals and leave the country, so be it. And that's sort of where we are now.
Okay. I want to make sure we get to talk about some other things today, too, especially about how we're covering race and free expression. It's on trial in courtrooms across the Midwest this week. We're going to start in Minneapolis, where jury selection is underway in the trial of Derek Chauvin. He's the police officer accused of second-degree murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. There's a piece in our Links blog, Ernest, that was written by the sheriff of Hennepin County, which promises protection of both free speech and public safety during and after this trial. Talk for a minute about what's at stake.
Well, basically what's at stake here is that what they don't want is they don't want to have another incident that happened with Rodney King back in the early 1990s. They don't want to have a situation that happened on the other side with O.J. Simpson and that sort of incident. They're trying to avoid this sort of issue where you have possible riots that happen either during the trial or after the trial is over. They're trying to avoid anything that can either have an impact on the trial itself or the aftermath of what the verdicts are going to be. And so, but in its heightened era of free speech as opposed to what is actually a protest, I guess the sheriff felt like, you know, he needed to come out and actually say, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to handle it.
Well, and this is a trial that is truly being seen around the world. NBC brought back its court TV programming on the new streaming service on Peacock. I can tell you that yesterday I was watching this on YouTube as it was being live streamed by the Star Tribune, by several of the different television stations in town. Kathy, if you had a chance to offer advice to the local journalists covering this trial and likely what is to be its aftermath, what would your advice to them be?
I would say don't anticipate and just cover what's in front of you. And I think it's really important for journalists not to throw gasoline on what could be a fire. I mean, that's what Ernest was talking about. So we really need to work hard to not sensationalize.
Ernest, would you give different advice to the national media that would be parachuting back into Minneapolis for the second time in a year?
Well, I would give a lot of what Kathy said, I would say the same thing to the national media. I mean, understand that, you know, the court of public opinion is different than the court within the justice system. And there's going to be a lot of information brought out by both the prosecution and the defense in order to win the trial. And they're trying to win this trial in terms of either the defense trying to get their client off, Chauvin, or the prosecution, which is trying to basically say that, yes, he is responsible for these crimes and should be punished for them. But in the scope of that, what you also have on trial here is whether or not the justice system in this country can actually work on behalf of Black Americans. And despite what we say and what we think, and even what happens in that courtroom, many people have already made up their mind about this because of that 9-minute videotape. And it is going to play over and over and over again, even more so now, I would think, than it did when it actually happened, because those of us who can remember back during the OJ trial, we saw the chase over and over and over again, more than we saw it when it actually happened. And I think you're going to see some of that in this case as well. And you're going to see a lot of it on cable and on the national media.
Do you think so? Or do you think that there might be journalists who make the decision because of the violence that is in this video that doesn't occur on that OJ video in the same way, that perhaps outlets might be a little bit more restrained? Yes, it may play again and again in the courtroom, but do you think that maybe people may consider the violent aspect and the graphic nature of that video before playing it again and again? I know George Floyd's brother has said he won't watch it again.
I think one thing is that the incidents that Ernest referred to, the earlier post-courtroom protests that turned violent, I think that will cause people to maybe hold back, as you are saying, Amy. I think that's going to be very much in a lot of media people's minds.
I would hope that they do, but I've been down this road several times before. And for those who make the decision to hold back, you're going to have others out there who are going to play that again. And the question becomes, are you going to have more of those who hold back than those who play it? That's what we're gonna find out.
And where or how might peer pressure influence or change decisions made once the station across the street shows it again?
Right.
Okay. Well, the killing of George Floyd led to protests across the country, around the world, during which journalists were among those arrested and taken into custody for not following police orders. Des Moines Register reporter Andrea Chowry live streamed her arrest.
I'm in the back of a cop car right now. I believe we haven't moved anywhere. I think we're still in Merrill Hay parking lot. But yeah, this, you know, I'm just doing my job as a journalist. I'm just out here reporting as I see. I asked why I was arrested, and they said, I think something about failing to disperse or something about that. And I said, well, I'm a journalist. And police informed me that I would have to report from further away. I said multiple times, I'm a, you know, reporter with the Des Moines Register.
So her trial started Monday in Des Moines. Kathy, the paper's editorial board came out this weekend and said that to even be having a trial for a reporter arrested while covering a protest is an outright violation of the free press. You are our free press expert. Your response to that?
Well, I have to say, based on what the prosecution presented this week, there's no question that the Des Moines Register editorial board is right. There was no case here. The arresting officer's body cam malfunctioned, and you know, maybe that's true, but the only video evidence of this arrest absolutely corroborated the reporter's story. You know, she could be audibly heard saying, I'm a journalist. And believe me, I've been in those situations before. Journalists stay as long as they have to and as long as they can to report a story. And it doesn't look like this woman was doing anything out of line. I'm frankly shocked and really dismayed that the Des Moines police would press this case. And I hope the jury does the right thing. It's, you know, it's almost as if they're trying to take advantage of what they think is an anti-press jury, or, you know, they hope the atmosphere will affect the jury to try to make a point. And I don't know what that point is other than they don't want people watching them. And that should make every American uncomfortable.
Shockingly, there are three other such trials that are slated to begin here in the next month in the United States of journalists who were arrested in similar situations. When I'm talking to people who are not journalists and bring up in conversation that according to Reporters Without Borders, in 2020, the United States ranked 45th out of 180 countries when it comes to freedom of the press. Ernest, if you were to point out one or two or three of the greatest threats to the domestic press right now, what would those be?
Right now, I would say that it is exactly what's happening in Iowa right now, is when you have police and prosecutors who basically will arrest reporters in the act of doing their jobs and reporting what they're doing. That is a threat, because if law enforcement and prosecutors are going to do that, then the next step will be, you know, politicians pretty much, you know, saying, hey, we don't care that you filed a FOIA, or we don't care that we're supposed to have an open meeting. We're going to violate that. What are you going to do about it? I mean, it does, in many ways, leads to a slippery slope. And even in looking at this trial, I mean, the fact that the body camera of this officer wasn't working. Well, my question would be, was it working before this happened? Was it working after this happened? let's ask that question. I mean, the fact that the prosecutor didn't even want the jury to know that the person on trial is a reporter. Mm-hmm. They wanted that taken out of the record. And the judge said, whoa, wait a minute, you can't do that. I mean, those are the kinds of things that, I mean, I'm with Kathy. Why are we even having this trial? It makes no sense to me when you have prosecutors and law enforcement basically saying, well, we're going to arrest you, but we're not going to tell the jury that you're a reporter. We're not going to be able, we're not going to explain that the body camera wasn't working. Oh, and by the way, we're going to ask the judge not to let the jury know that the body camera wasn't working and that there was some sort of malfunction. I mean, this whole trial sort of leads down this road of, well, if we can get this done, if we can prosecute this reporter, then all bets are off on a lot of First Amendment rights that the press has worked very hard for in order to be able to tell the public what its officials are doing, those who are being paid by their tax dollars.
Okay, so we only have about 2 more minutes, and I wanted to make sure we had a chance to talk today about Roy Blunt's announcement on Monday that he is not going to be running for his Senate seat again. Some of that coverage from around the state, a lot of Missourians as surprised as I was by his reaction there, or by his announcement there. Kathy, I was taken by some of the opinion pieces in the Kansas City Star that set some of this up, saying that the party shifted too quickly for him and he doesn't have a place in it anymore. What does your gut say? Is that what it is, or retire before I can be primaried?
Well, you know, Roy Blunt is 71 years old, which by most of our listener standards probably seems like a normal retirement age, but in Senate years, not so much. I mean, we have Chuck Grassley in neighboring Iowa trying to decide whether to run again at age 87. So I would say yes. I think that the changing politics are going to impact Blunt's decision. I think that had to be a factor. But for Missouri, I think what this means is in 2020, we were ignored because we were, people wrote us off correctly as an easy win for Trump. This is going to bring a national spotlight to the state because I think there will be a fight on the Republican side to say which kind of Republican are we going to nominate, a Roy Blunt style Republican or a more Josh Hawley Trump style Republican. I think there'll be a lot of questions about does the former president get involved, and the Democrats will try to make it competitive. So we'll be in the national spotlight here in Missouri, and there'll be a lot of money spent.
Well, there have already been comparisons that perhaps in 2022, Missouri is going to be the next Arizona or the next Georgia. So we will have a lot to cover and talk about that. Well, music means we are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. And you can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. You can find that under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us questions, comments, and see what we'll be talking about next week. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show and Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our theme music. I'm Amy Simons, and we'll be with you again next week for another edition of Views of the News.